chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them, but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. I'm your host, Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. So we are still in Pride Month. We are still in the midst of civil upheavals in our country about racial justice. But the film that we're talking about this week has nothing to do with any of those things. Or does it? Or does it? Let's find out. Our guest this week on the show is Jennifer Haining. Jennifer, could you tell the people a little about yourself?
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer Haining. Jenny, if you're nasty, I don't know. So I live in New York. I'm like a comic actor, voiceover artist, server, production coordinator, all of the things. I met you and Eliza when I was at American University doing film and theater stuff, and now I have a show coming out, a season one of a show called Super Powerless on Instagram TV. So that's been like the big thing I've been working on during quarantine. I'm also on like a sketch team here, and just waiting to see when that service and or production job's coming back. So,
all right, well, so Jenny, the movie that we are talking about this week is a classic of the rom-com genre that I've actually recommended on the show before as an antidote to another film, but that is not going to keep me from tearing it to shreds, so I'm pretty excited about this one. It's My Best Friend's Wedding, 1997, starring the iconic rom-com actress Julia Roberts. So here is the Google summary. Childhood friends Julianne Potter, played by Julia Roberts, and Michael O'Neill, played by Dermot Mulroney, had a deal to marry each other if they were still single by age 28. Now, 4 days before her 28th birthday, O'Neill announces that he's marrying a gorgeous 20-year-old named Kimberly, Cameron Diaz. Suddenly, realizing that she's actually in love with him, Julianne vows to stop the wedding at any cost. However, when she is appointed maid of honor, things get even more complex. All right, Jenny. So that's what Google says this movie is about. But I now posit to you, what is this movie really about?
Okay, so My Best Friend's Wedding is about, it's about two people who are only 28, who are acting as if they're like 40-ish years old. Because I feel like the packs are always, oh, we're both 40 or 50, we'll get together, you know, we can marry each other if we haven't found anyone by then. But they've chosen the number 28 for some reason. And he has found a young lady who can't even drink yet in the United States and decided to marry her. And it's his best friend who has, I don't think, ever been in love with him, decides that she suddenly is because I think she sort of thinks she owns him a little bit. And so she decides to break up the wedding, not necessarily out of love, but more out of, like a sort of ownership or like spite, really. And I don't know that she's wrong in that decision because, again, he's 28 only. And this young lady who is lovely, Cameron Diaz, is only 20. It's a lovely story about going for what you want or really not doing that. So, My Best Friend's Wedding.
I really did early on in this movie. I think there's a scene when Julianne first meets Kimberly, Kim. Mm-hmm. And Kim drives so fast in this little Corvette or whatever. Because, as you say, she's 20 years old. She can't drink. She's so young. She's basically still a kid. And I just was thinking to myself, like, on some level, this could be recut to be a horror movie.
Right. I was watching the movie again earlier because it's been years, and I wrote a note here that says I like how they're speeding down Lakeshore Drive, and it's a very like literal and metaphorical thing about how Julianne, is that her name?
Julianne.
Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
it's like a great metaphor for how she starts like spiraling and spinning out, you know, when she sees her and when she meets her. And I was like, this is very on the nose. But then they keep going with every time Cameron Diaz is in a car, she's driving very recklessly, and they never address it again. So,
which is somewhat hilarious because she dresses like a mom from the mid-1960s.
Sure.
So it's very, I think that there's definitely something to be said, as you allude to, that the people who wrote this screenplay don't understand what a 20-year-old is or mm-hmm. what a 28-year-old is.
No, I don't think either of those things. Also, it's funny looking at what 28-year-olds look like on film now and what they looked like then, because 28-year-olds now look like they're 16. And 28-year-olds then look like they're mid-30s, early 40s. And you're like, okay. They talk about, they make a big deal in the beginning, and they've said it a couple times about how she for her job is like a food critic, but that's never important. And like never, it just doesn't matter to the plot or any, like it just, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, from a, there's a lot to be said about the structure of this film in terms of its like, I don't want to say it's an anti-feminist film. That's not fair. Mm. But I would say that it is not exactly in dialogue with the themes of women's liberation. And the fact that Julianne's job is basically used as a like cipher, like a shorthand for the fact that she, according to Kim, Cameron Diaz's character, doesn't do quote unquote feminine priorities like
right.
marriage and love.
And the color pink. Don't forget the color pink.
And the color pink. Yeah, so I think that the fact that they never get into her job as a food critic in New York, which is an incredibly lucrative job because it's not exactly, if you're making a living from being a food critic in New York, you basically work for the New York Times or equivalent publication.
100%.
So the fact that that's not her big passion in life truly does not make sense. It uh-huh. is true.
Yeah. And this is a movie that definitely does not pass the Bechdel test by any means. However, I also find it disturbing when I'm watching the movie and the character I like the most is the guy. Like I end up looking at him and being like, I mean, he's the only one who hasn't really done anything like wrong or truly annoying, but he does. We'll get into that. But
like you said, he's initially sort of like a pawn in Julianne's, which I can only describe as a spiral is the word you use. And I think that that's accurate. A sort of like quarter life spiral where because her friend is getting married, she suddenly feels like her life is falling apart because he was sort of her life plan and she didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. So he's basically a pawn in her story, which feels like, in some ways, you know, not a bad storyline. But then it goes terribly, terribly wrong,
yeah.
I'd say.
It skews pretty left, I think.
Yeah, the girl world politics, I think, between Kim and Julianne are troubling.
Yeah, there's a lot to be desired there as far as their relationship goes, I think. But, you know, they made up in a bathroom, so at least we had that.
As all women do, you fight in elevators and you make up in bathrooms.
And you make up
That's
in a bathroom.
That's a known fact.
With multiple other women around cheering you on.
Well, why don't we get into Michael, though? So where does Michael start to falter for you? He was your favorite character and then he wasn't.
Okay, so it's kind of like, he actually, as time went on, I started liking him more. But when he started out, I was like, okay, screw this dude. Because one of the first things that they have him doing is she is in her underwear changing and he walks in the room and is staring at her, Julianne. And he walks in and looks at her and she puts a towel over herself and he's like, I've seen you far more naked than that. And it's like, right, but you're not together, so like I don't understand, even if you're her best friend, where the entitlement comes from that like he's like, drop the towel, girl, I'm getting married tomorrow, but like it's fine. And then that rubbed me the wrong way in that, you know, he was like, I've seen it, I, you know, which means I can see it now. So I thought that was a little jarring. And then he's just very close to Julianne's face the whole movie in a way that you're like, you can't be this stupid. Like every time they have a moment and he keeps being like, what's wrong? Are you okay? what do you have to say? And it's like, it's pretty obvious. And then to get the ring off her finger later, he sucks on her finger. And that's when I was like, all right, I think I'm cashed out on this guy.
So what do you think, because this was a thought that occurred to me while I was watching this movie also, what do you think are the chances that Julianne and Michael are just like raging sociopaths?
Sure. I would say like a 98.5. I was reading an article about how it was like the dark genius of My Best Friend's Wedding, and it was kind of about how love, rather than fixing all of their problems, like love kind of beats them all. They obviously have an unrequited chemistry there, which at 28 is not going to go away. Like Cameron Diaz is so young and has so much ahead of her, and they don't really resolve her giving up all of her dreams for him. Like they kind of don't ever say that she ended up not doing that. And so I feel like the marriage took that away from her. And then, of course, Julianne is a lonely 28-year-old spinster at the end whose gay best friend has to come save her. So, you know, love didn't make them better people, I don't think, really. It just kind of fueled the fire of, yeah, what I think would be two sociopaths involving and a young girl caught up in their relationship. For sure.
A poor, impressionable pawn in their sociopathic sexual mind games.
A high-energy pawn.
There's two questions I'd like to ask based on what you just said. And one is about, I think I'll start first with talking about the 28-year-old spinster.
Sure.
As a person who recently left the land of being 28, I found myself deeply caught up in this film's narrative, and I wasn't sure if it's the movie's narrative or it's just Julianne's. Is it the film's belief that she is actually sort of like lost in love, or are we supposed to believe that that's just a theory that Julianne has about herself? Because of course, I mean, Kim even brings up like, oh, Michael's told me about how hard it's been for you. You've been with all these men and all these broken relationships, and you finally found someone. Yeah, how did that strike you? Her spinsterdom.
I will not lie. Since I remember watching this film so often when I was very young, I now, watching it today, I turned 29 a couple weeks ago, and I just remember from earlier today, she said, oh, we're both 28. We made this pact when we were 28. It hit me like a brick. Because I was like, oh, I didn't know. It was confusing for me whether the writer and director truly thought that, or you're right, if it was something she was putting on herself. It seems like whoever wrote or directed this kind of felt that way. Felt like 28 was a good number to throw in there rather than like 40 or 50 or whatever. Because maybe it's because they wanted to have a younger looking cast or, you know, whatever. But not even 30. They took 28. And it's just, it was such a specific thing that I'm not sure if there was a choice behind it or if that's just, I actually don't know how old she was I don't know how old Julia Roberts was. Maybe she was around 28. Because this was a movie that was supposed to be like a star engine for her, they called it. And then it kind of became about the three of them. But it was a movie that was basically written for her. And so maybe she was 28. I'm not sure. But that number is, I mean, for me, it's super jarring. And for me, I felt like they had an original ending that they didn't have, which is that she met a guy at the wedding. And people, apparently, when they showed it, people were so angry that, because they weren't ready to forgive her for the very bad stuff that she did. And so they were like, don't reward her with a man. And they refused to give her an ending where she just like was kind of unhappy but accepting about her friend at the wedding. They were like, that's way too depressing. And I feel like now that would be something that women would like, in that we're like, yeah, she's 28 alone at this wedding, but the point would be that she has so much time ahead of her because she's only 28. But instead, they had her friend come in and sort of save her as if to say, oh, you know, she's going to be all right. And it's like, it's just a very strange concept that you know, if she couldn't find love, at least she's got her friend. And it's like, she's only 28. It made me feel actual fear that this is a number that mattered. And I know it does not.
I felt exactly the same way. I felt like, I think that was where the horror movie feelings were coming in for me, is that I think I actually even wrote down in my notes, like, this is a single woman in her late 20s, early 30s, like, true horror movie. That you find yourself possessed by the narrative that you are going to die alone and that society looks upon you as, like, a washed-up spinster. So you mm-hmm. treat people like garbage around you because you're so caught up in this narrative.
Right.
And the fact that Kim is 20... and still in college. She's, I mean, it junior. Just like, emphasizes it.
Oh, they're so big on how she's a junior. And I, like, if she was another 28-year-old, the movie wouldn't have been different, was the other thing. It's like the mm-hmm. choice to make her incredibly younger, not incredible, but 8 years is a lot in that time frame because mm-hmm. it's college to full adulthood. It feels almost misogynistic to have him. He found his happiness with the younger, you know, like, newer girl, and it's like, I don't think it would have been different if she was just their age. Their age never really came that much into play as far as the plot was concerned.
Right, and yet it's left for us to sort of walk away with, oh yeah, but as, you know, Julianne says, like, Kim is not perfect, but she's young and she's naive and her imperfection's really charming, whereas Julianne is, like, old and bitter and yep. professional.
And that's just how she's going to be. She's settled at 28 and she can't change.
That's it. She's done. She's got her GBF and she's great. Let's talk about the gay best friend, because in my Please. Estimation and in my memory, this is the first film I remember seeing with a gay best friend as a marked character.
Right. And actually, I think he's fascinating because he's actually one of my favorite gay best friend characters in film. Because for him being the first one, I understand that what they probably did was they wanted to make him more subtle so that it wasn't, you know, like, too shocking for like people who felt more conservatively. They didn't want to chase them away from this movie. But I actually, like, he's the most realistic kind of gay best friend. And especially at 28, I thought I really liked his energy, and I liked that he was just kind of, him being gay was not part of his whole identity. Like, he was just, the only reason they had him be gay. Well, okay, so it bothered me that the only reason he was gay was that meant they couldn't possibly be together and so they could be best friends. It drives me crazy that he couldn't have just been her best friend who was trying to give her this advice. It always has to be a gay best friend because women cannot be friends with straight men. And it's like, okay, that's silly. But him as a gay character, I love, because I feel like, especially now, there's this trope, right, with, like, straight white girls and their gay best friend who's just, like, so flamboyant or so over the top because they're trying to play quote-unquote gay, which is a very unfair stereotype. And, like, if you are someone who is more flamboyant and also gay, that's great. If you're not, also great. But I feel like that's always the trope in a movie, that it's, like, the super energetic, supportive gay best friend who's just like, you do it, girl, and, like, will push her to that person. But I liked that this guy was just kind of chill, and I love that conversation in the car where she's chasing, there's the car chase at the end, which would have killed so many people. They weren't even looking. It was bad. But I like that on the phone he's like, is anyone chasing you? And she goes, no. And he goes, okay, well, there's your answer. So, like, get, you know, lay off now because you lose and you have your answer. And I was like, I don't not like that as a concept. It's just, mm-hmm. But again, it's like a man had to tell her that. So it's like, I don't know. Yeah, I like that he was just a person and was also gay, you know? And I think that we need a lot more of that because there's a lot of stereotyping that goes on, especially now.
I think that's a really good point. And the fact that he serves not as this, like, fairy godmother, because I think sometimes the gay best friend serves that function in films.
It's like, where, their magic, yeah.
Yeah, or where they, like, tap their wand on you, their gay wand, and then suddenly you're made over and you're more attractive to straight men for some reason, which doesn't really map. But instead, he's a very sensible voice of reason in this movie at every stage, and he's telling her to be very straightforward. It's just very human advice. Although I think, to your point about him having to be gay and a man, is interesting too, because I thought a lot in this movie about why Julianne doesn't have a female friend that we see, and that she immediately has such an adversarial relationship to Kim. And it really made me think a lot about the way femininity and female friendships are represented in this film too, and like how women relate to each other.
I actually wrote down here, I was like, actually very cool to see a like a straight male friend of a woman. I was like, I don't see that often. And then they were like, he's gay. And I was like, okay, fine, whatever. Like, we're doing a trope, but cool. It would have been just as easy to have her have a female friend. I'm happy they chose someone to represent the gay community. Like, that's good. And that started. Women are only adversaries until they're not in this film. There's no support system between each other until the very end, and it's still the only reason is because it's about a man.
Yes.
And yeah, and even that, like the two bratty the sisters that are really annoying, they're awful to each other. Like, she's like, my sister got her tongue stuck on the ice, and it's hilarious, and it's like, that's awful.
I think it's really intriguing, speaking of like how women are represented, that this is, I mean, there are so many Julia Roberts rom-coms, but when I think of them, this is usually the first one I think of. So one of my questions is, how is it that Julia Roberts, who is and was America's sweetheart, played this deeply, deeply unlikable character? I mean, how does that play for you on film?
I guess that's true. She always plays characters that are very, very loved and kind of like the flawless, you know, even like Pretty Woman. It's like she's this, you know, she's like, we see her improvement and like we love her as a person. And yeah, she's kind of like a shitty person, especially with the emails and the email writing and everything. That's very conniving. But I think it was done on purpose, because if she was an unattractive woman doing all of these things, people either wouldn't have enjoyed the movie, or it would have just been easily acceptable that she was the villain. So again, I think it's a choice to be like, we'll have Julia Roberts do it. She'll be really good at it because she's a great actress, but she's still beautiful enough, and she'll, you know, when she emotes, you feel bad enough because she's so physically attractive that, and like, you know, because of the other things she's played, we know her as someone we love. And so it was definitely, it's always a choice to stick the bad people as being someone who ultimately you're still going to be attracted to. But I think if it was someone less known, less attractive, you know, it would be a different story. So I think it was definitely intentional casting, and I think she did a great job playing it. But it is interesting that my favorite scene in the film is the one when I think she's being the most genuinely good. I don't know what that says or not. But when she's with his family at the baseball game, and you're seeing how much history they have together, and she's like doing funny voices and playing with his brother and his dad and all these people that she's known all her life, I thought that was very endearing and sweet. And I wanted more of that in the movie.
There's something about her appeal where she can do a lot of really mean-spirited stuff, and you can forgive her.
And like, this is a whole other subject, but I truly believe that it does have a lot to do with, this sounds so dumb, but like facial symmetry in women, because it's the same thing where she's obviously a great actress, but I've always kind of had this thing where it's kind of hard to tell who's actually a great actress and who is just beautiful enough that when they do emote, it looks appealing in a way that makes you feel something because symmetrically it works out.
So here's a weird thing that I noticed about this movie that I did not notice before. And it is, you know, you do musical theater now and again, a little bit. And music plays actually a big role in this film in a way that I had forgotten about. And weirdly enough, almost all of it is music from that 60s era of black girl groups. What do you think about that, and why are those songs so prominent in this movie?
I actually was thinking about that today, and I I was even trying to Google it. I do not understand directorially or anything why they were there. I don't actually understand why it opened with the Wishin' and Hopin' sequence that it opens with. I don't understand why they do 68 versions of Say a Little Prayer. Like, which, by the way, it's a bunch of white people in a room clapping on the one instead of the two, and it drives me insane. Oh my God.
That's the thing, this is the whitest movie of all time, and they are constantly singing black music, and it is so confusing.
I wrote it down here. There are two people of color in this film, and there's like one guy at the wedding, and then there's two women in the background where while the two white girls are fighting over the bouquet, it's two women of color just standing behind them, kind of looking at them like, okay. And I'm like, all right, like lineless people. And then if you look at the crowd, even of the wedding, you're like, this is the whitest film. It's just a sea of pale faces. The spontaneous breaking out into song, him singing to her on the boat. I was like, I was like, being even involved with musical theater, we don't just start singing to each other. That's not a thing. But in this film, they made it such a prominent thing. Even with the guys sucking in the helium and singing it like they were gathered around a streetlight. It's very like Temptations-y. I'm just not sure why the choice was made for me personally.
I find it like the racial component is totally confounding. And I think the one thing that I was thinking about was, well, this music to me, like the Temptations and like early Aretha Franklin and Dionne Warwick and all these songs that they evoke, they do make me think of like an Americana sense of like an earlier time of love, you know, going to the chapel and we're going to get married, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff where, you know, people did get married when they were 20 to a person they met 3 weeks later, a la, you know, Kim and Michael in this movie. Mm-hmm. And maybe the movie's trying to like return us to that period of time to think about like traditional marriage, but then that doesn't go anywhere. It's really strange because, again, this is like many rom-coms, I'm never quite sure how the movie itself feels about marriage.
Mm-hmm. Right,
because Michael and Kim are not being set up for a successful union here, but that's not really what the movie cares about anyway.
Right. And also, if you're gonna go for an Americana kind of situation, it again, as we are dealing with in the world, it feels strange to have an all-white cast of people, but to be borrowing what's essentially mostly black music and music stylings when there's Frankie Valli and a bunch of other things that do the same thing, but don't... It's not that it's insulting to use those things, but it's so specifically culturally black artists, and I find it so strange in a film that's... so white and could have just easily done like it could have put Can't Take My Eyes Off of You in there just as easily as it did Say a Little Prayer for You.
Well, given that you are from Chicago, I feel like it's important too to talk about how the whiteness of this movie is especially weird because it's set in Chicago. So can you talk about the role Chicago plays in this movie, if at all?
I mean, yeah, so in this film they do not step outside of... Actually, the church they use is a Presbyterian church where it's actually pretty non-denominational, so I guess that one is different. But where they are filming in Chicago and where they film the wedding and stuff, which I will get to because I have a relationship to that, it is only incredibly upper class, like... typically white, especially I guess in the 90s, like areas of Chicago. They show the city line and stuff, but it's definitely the business district sort of Chicago. It's not really like where the actual homes are or anything like that. It definitely went for like the ritzy Chicago feel. And like when they pull off Lakeshore Drive, even they pull their cars off into this center area that where they were going when they were going right, it would have been like Trump Tower right there, which mm-hmm. wasn't Trump Tower at the time, but it's this very ritzy, rich neighborhood. So there was definitely a market they were trying to reach with this film. And like it makes sense for who the family is and everything. But they also chose to shoot, they shot all the wedding scenes at, it's called Cuneo Mansion. And like the reason I know all this is because my brother used to date the daughter of the curator of Cuneo Mansion. It's upstate. And we were actually on the grounds. I was very small when they were filming the scene where they're like chasing each other. And when they were, we were doing some of the, when they were filming some of the other scenes at the wedding. And Cuneo too is a very, like, Cuneo is a very rich, very old money type of mansion. So they, I mean, again, there's definitely just like a demographic that they're trying to reach there. And that doesn't mean that it's bad, but it's just, it lends again to choices that seem disjointed from one another. So I'm not sure, but yeah, it's definitely not the it's not the Chicago that everyone who lives in Chicago knows for sure. Even where they get on the L, it's like the, it's basically like the Times Square stop where they get on the train.
It does, it is funny to me anytime a rom-com leaves New York or LA. So it always strikes me as like, oh, well, they must be making this choice for a specific reason. And I wonder if, do you think that there's a reason why this movie is set in Chicago?
I feel like when you make movies about New York, it's either the incredibly high class elite or most movies about New York, which are focus on like the grittier areas where it's like uptown and Harlem and bodegas and, you know, shit where you're like, yeah, that's New York. Like, but when you do, I feel like people think of Chicago as, you know, like a cleaner, more upscale, kind of tamer New York. And so this is where that would be. Chicago is kind of an ideal setting. And there's just, there's an incredibly diverse population of all different types of people and living and blah, blah, blah. But I do feel like Chicago often gets the rep of like, I don't know, just being like the very sleek and clean. When you film in Chicago, it's more of a, I don't know, it's more business class or whatever, but.
But nice, you know, nice to get a reprieve of the, you know, sweeping helicopter shots of Manhattan, you know, every once in a while with these rom-coms.
Same shots that you're just like, yep, there's Central Park. There it is.
It's the big
thing in the middle. But I also will say, I do wish that the movie ended with her alone. It's so sweet, the scene where her friend comes in, because he's wonderful, and it's such, it is really lovely to watch. But I think it would have been kind of ahead of its time if it just had her alone and some sort of realization that she's 28. She's got her whole life and world ahead of her, and apparently a pretty incredible job waiting for her when she gets home. So she's going to be fine. She just needs to be sad at that wedding, you know? I think it would have been interesting. But, you know, rom-com comedy. So, ended happy.
I have to say that, like, my heart grew so full when you said, you know, you've got your whole life ahead of you. You're going to be fine. You just need to be sad at that wedding. Like, there was part of me that was like, Jenny's talking about me.
Yes, because we're getting to that point, right, where we've been to so many weddings and we, like, you know, at 28 is the time when you start, 29 is when you start kind of freaking out, but you're like, it's, you know, 30 is a weird number. We put a weird thing on the number 30. And it's, you know, it's something that I've had to reconcile lately, being like, oh my God, it's 30 means nothing. Like, 30 is a new 20, they say, whatever. But I'm glad I could help your heart.
Time is an illusion.
Time doesn't exist, especially in a quarantine.
Ain't that the truth? Yeah. Well, on that note, time doesn't matter. 30 is the new 20. These are all great things. Also great are our Patreon patrons, who I need to shout out really quickly. They are Esther, Bob, Sean, Robert, and Tim. You all are... Oh, and Emily. You can't forget Emily. You rock. Anyway, y'all are the best. You continue to be great. Thank you so much for all of your support. Okay. So, this is my favorite part of every show. Jenny, what is your antidote for my best friend's wedding?
Can I two-part it in a way?
Yes.
Okay, so, antidote. First of all, 28 is a terrible cutoff point. Please, if you're out there and you're 28, don't take this, take that as a marker. That was a terrible choice for this film. But I think what we can take from it is, you know, if you love somebody, only once they're with someone else, you might not love them. And then further, if you do love someone and you really, really think that that's who you want to be with, tell them much earlier than the night before their wedding would be my recommendation section. I think that everyone needs to watch Crazy Rich Asians all the time. I think that it's one of the first films that I've seen where the women aren't relying on the men to figure things out. The women are very much relying on one another. And when the men cut in, they're like, shh, I'm thinking, shush, hold on. And it's like that, I think, that's a movie that can rival any other rom-com. It's adorable, but it's also, it's the ladies are so dang powerful in that film. And I recommend it. And then if you know what? I don't love rom-coms in general. They're cute, but if you want something that's just different and fun, I always recommend Avengers Endgame. It's my favorite thing in the world. It's a completely different genre, and you can get out of the often anti-feminist rom-com.
My antidote for My Best Friend's Wedding is looking at this similar time frame in your life, like you, Jenny, looking at this like late 20s time frame where life gets a little bit weird, but also thinking about this question of like, what do you do with the love of your best friend at this time in your life where you're starting to think about settling down with a romantic partner? And a movie that I saw recently that I really loved on this topic is called Life Partners, 2014. Jillian Jacobs and Leighton Meester play best friends. One is straight, the other is gay, but they've basically lived through their 20s together in LA and supported each other through lots of relationships and breakups. But then the straight one wants to settle down and like really get married. The gay one is having some hard times with that because their friendship is so close and they've got this really wonderful bond. But it really undermines this idea that to be attached to your best friend, you have to be romantically in love with them. And I just really thought that this movie really captured something about friendships between women and the intimacy there. And it's also just great because it's got a great cast. So I would check that out.
I love what you've just said there. You can have straight male best friends and you can have, I don't know, whatever your best friends are, whoever your best friends are and your sexual preferences with one another. If you share the same sexual preferences and that would happen to be each other, it doesn't matter. That doesn't mean anything other than what you want it to mean. And even, you know.
So good. Well, Jenny, this was great. I haven't talked to you in such a freaking long time. So this was awesome.
This was great. Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on. And thanks for recommending Avengers Endgame, because honestly, yes, no more rom-coms.
I mean, if you want a love letter that is not a rom-com, that movie is a love letter to its fan base. And I will plug it for the rest of time.
Listen, team, different kinds of love. We accept different all different kinds of love.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked this episode, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Rom-Com Killjoys. And if you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys to gain access to exclusive bonus content. Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog. And the song you're listening to now is a cover of one of my favorites, Baby Love, by Colin Langanis. Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy. Not a rom-com, not me, not anyone. See you next time.